Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading thinkers from the University of Oxford and beyond. Today, we're discussing the rising global trend of companies and governments being taken to court for not taking enough action to prevent climate change. To date, there have been climate change cases in at least 28 countries, from Greta Thunberg leading a group of young people in filing a lawsuit against five countries at the UN, to the Hague Court of Appeals upholding an historic ruling ordering the Dutch government to more quickly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Increasing numbers of people are taking legal action together to demand governments do more. And they're not the only ones under the microscope. Oil and gas providers are also being grilled, or should that be drilled? In October, in New York, ExxonMobil were taken to court for fraud, and various oil and gas companies are being sued by US cities. So what does this rise in litigious climate action mean for society as we race to meet climate targets? And how should lawmakers and scientists work together in this growing field? With me to discuss this today are Freddie Otto, Acting Director of the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford, and a lead author on extremes in weather in the ongoing assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Liz Fisher, Professor of Environmental Law at Oxford and General Editor of the Journal of Environmental Law, and Miles Allen, Professor of Geosystem Science and a lead author on the IPCC's special report on 1.5 degrees. Welcome to you all and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Freddie, to start with you, when we spoke in episode 5 of Future Makers, we discussed court cases in Australia and the Netherlands. Can you remind us briefly what those were and provide some context for our discussion today?
Being very conscious that we have a lawyer here in the room, the one in the Netherlands was against the Dutch government, where the Dutch government has said that they would reduce their emissions to by a certain amount to a certain date, but then failed to do so. And so in this case called the Urgenda case, the argument was really, well, that you, Dutch government, have said you would reduce the emissions and you were not doing what you have said you would do. So that was the argument. And I think it's on appeal for the third time now at the Supreme Court. But the case was won in the last two courts. And in Australia, it was against opening a new coal mine. And the argument there was very much on what we talked about in the last episode of the Paris Agreement, that the Paris Agreement says, the Annex 1 countries, so the most developed countries, have to lead or are leading in their ambitions. And so Australia is one of these countries. So it's really irrelevant what the rest of the world is doing, but Australia can't open a new coal mine and dig out more coal to be burned and release more fossil fuels. And so to your question about the context, I think at the moment when we are talking about climate change and what to do about climate change and how to reduce our emissions, a lot of the discussion is on individual action. But actually, what we need to do in order to stop emitting carbon from burning fossil fuels is really to completely change the system our society is based on, which is based on burning fossil fuels. And it's countries and in particular also companies who are digging up the coal and who are burning the coal and also other fossil fuels. And by looking at them in litigation and in court cases, one thing we will definitely achieve is to at least shift the conversation on these actors in our society. So that's, I think, one reason why talking about court cases and climate litigation is really important, and they can play a very important role. They will certainly not solve the problem.
Right. Thank you very much indeed. Liz, the trend of suing over climate seems to be growing. If so, why? And what would you say the legal landmarks have been?
So to begin with, you used the language of suing, and before you talked about sort of being litigious. And these are two really negative terms, and suggesting that these are kind of undesirable things. But the reality is climate change is increasingly a problem for communities across the world. Likewise, states are taking action on climate change, and passing legislation, signing up to international treaties, and so creating regulatory regimes. And so legal disputes over climate change are inevitable. And that's why we're seeing the growth. And you know, you can count thousands of cases across the world where climate change is figuring. Now, why it's figuring in these cases varies significantly. So if I take the cases that Freddie gave, one is an example, the agenda case, of where you have a group of citizens in a country saying to a government, actually, you haven't done what you said you would. We need to hold you to account. And law has always played a very important role in holding governments to account. The second example from Australia of the coal mine is a different type of litigation where the question is, you know, how do we assess the impact of a project on the environment? And historically, climate change has been very hard to take into account in that kind of impact assessment process because we didn't design those impact assessment processes for, you know, thinking about the climate. But it clearly is that a coal mine will have an impact on the environment, and that's why it's being taken into account. Now, I could point to many other examples of where you have someone in Peru bringing an action against a Germany energy producer in Germany under German law for saying what you are doing in emitting CO2 is causing adverse impacts on my property in Peru. Now, that might sound very strange. The first time I heard of this case, I thought, you've got to be kidding, because that's not how we think about causation. We think about causation in a far more direct way. You know, I throw something at Miles and I hit him on the head. But actually, when you start thinking about climate science, it is not a world away from that. What is different is this kind of collective, you know, collective contribution and a kind of collective impact. So this case law is growing. Are there landmark cases? Most of these cases are in national regimes. And for those countries and for those legal cultures, these are landmarks. They are also being taken account of in other legal systems. They're inspiration for other judges. But this is not a kind of global body of climate change law.
Can you say a little bit more about the Peru case? It does sound on the face of it astonishing. So you've got someone in Peru taking a German company to court.
So they're actually taking the German company to court in Germany.
Right.
Under the German civil code.
Because of emissions made where?
Emissions made by German energy producers in Germany.
And because of their impact in Peru?
Because of their impact
in Peru. So why are they picking on Germany? I mean, why not pick on emissions from just about anywhere else in the world?
Well, so partly is it turns on the German civil code. And there is a very simple provision in the German civil code which says that you cannot interfere with other people's property. If you do, either there should be an injunction or there should be compensation.
Right.
So part of it is reflecting here is a legal obligation in that legal system. Now, what this case is really doing is, well, how do we make sense of that legal obligation in light of climate change?
Right. But is the German company being picked on simply because Germany is a country that has this written into its legal code?
I can't. So I haven't been involved why the case was brought. I think just coming back to, you know, how we think about climate change is because it's a collective action problem. Of course, it's tempting to say any case is picking on an individual person.
Yeah.
But of course, and this really comes back to what Freddie was saying, you know, what we're needing to do, particularly in terms of law, is change the ways we think about responsibility, change the ways both for states and for individuals and those doing business. And in this regard, I know, Miles, back in 2003, you wrote a piece on legal liability for climate change. And I was just wondering, as a scientist, why did you do that?
Well, yeah, because it wasn't particularly about the law. I was no lawyer then, still aren't now. But the question really was more about where was attribution science going. We'd been working away on how much of the global warming was due to human influence, and we were answering that question progressively more definitively, to the point that it was getting kind of boring. So the next question was, well, what was the science going to do next? And of course, you know, the next challenge for attribution science, after you've established what's going on at the global level, is how is climate change actually affecting people? Because that's what people really care about. And at that time, it was pretty much routine. Whenever a weather event happened, four scientists to come out and say, yes, this is weather. It's not climate. Climate and weather are different. You can't attribute any single weather event to climate change. And that kind of shut down the conversation about whether there was any potential for actual harm being ascribed to greenhouse gas emissions. And so what I was asking in that article was really, what would it take for that to change? And thanks to work, a lot of it done here in Oxford by Freddie's group and others, that situation does seem to have changed. And people seem to be much more comfortable now, 15 years on, with talking about actual harm being caused by emissions remotely in, you know, at very different points in time and different points in space.
So the problem of attribution has been tackled quite successfully, or is being tackled quite successfully?
Well, I think we understand the problem. It doesn't make it easy to answer it, but we've got a framework to address how emissions in one place can contribute to harm in another. A lot of it's built around the whole notion of probabilistic causation, how, you know, you can take an action which increases the risk of something occurring, even if it might have happened anyway. And lawyers in other contexts as well are getting to grips with that kind of causation relating to increasing risks rather than causation being black and white.
Freddie, you've done a lot of work on attribution. Could you tell us a bit about that?
I think that that's exactly as Miles was saying, that what we are doing is not, there will never be an extreme weather event or a climate impact that is solely caused by greenhouse gas emissions, because there are always different causes to what actually damages people. So there's always a big aspect of vulnerability and exposure, but also in the weather system, there is natural variability in just the chaotic nature of the climate and weather system, and then land use changes, or whether the event is happening over a city or a forest plays an important role. But because of the increased greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the likelihood and intensity of extreme weather events is changing, and with the framework of event attribution that we've developed, we can in many cases now say by how much. So we can say, for example, for the heat wave that was happening in France in July this year, that heat wave would have been 4 degrees cooler at the beginning of the 20th century. We can also go a step further. And for example, we know how many greenhouse gases a certain company has emitted, or how many greenhouse gases have been emitted over a certain territory. So we can say, for example, we've done a study on a heat wave in Argentina, which in total was made about 5 times more likely because of all the emissions put together. But we can say that the emissions from Europe made this heat wave about 30% more likely.
Just to clarify there, I take it what you mean is that we have some heat wave in Argentina or wherever that reaches a certain temperature for a certain period. And what you're doing is saying, if you wind back to lower concentrations of carbon or whatever it would be, the probability of a heat wave of that temperature and duration coming about would have been so much less than it now is.
Yeah, exactly. And you have already pointed to the well, we can do this. We have this scientific framework, and once we have defined what the meteorological or weather event is that led to the impacts, then we can do the calculations. But there is not the one correct definition of a weather event. So when you look at a heat wave, you can define a heat wave just as the cool summer temperature, or you can define a heat wave, which is usually what you read in the newspaper, about the record hitting maximum temperature. But actually what affects people, for example, is when you have night and day temperatures very high over a number of days. So in that case, you will probably define it as a 5-day average temperature event or so. And depending on that definition, you will get different numbers when you do the scientific calculations. So in all these studies, there are questions that you need to answer that are outside the science.
And how much have these sorts of attribution studies fed so far into legal cases?
I would say, and Freddie and Miles might have a better feeling for this, not much.
Because actually, I would have said not at all.
and the reason for that, and I think this is, you know, really significant, is these cases are being brought where actually the science is pretty clear.
Right.
So if we take the cases against the government, it's usually, you know, the government has already recognized that there is a problem with climate change. and it's really holding the government to account.
And this is often where the government itself has put targets in place.
Yes, and it may be that those targets were in policy. It may be that they were in legislation.
Right.
Now, that kind of targets are actually quite legally novel in themselves. And so there's a question about how do you legally enforce them, which has made this litigation interesting. But if we think about the case, the Peruvian case, or there was a case in India last year, that is about melting glaciers, which I imagine it's far more straightforward to see what is actually happening.
Yeah, and that I would have corrected myself. To my knowledge, there is not a case about a very specific damage to a very specific weather event. But as you said, the melting glacier argument is where also the chain of causality is important in the case.
And I think the overall context has evolved. Certainly I find in discussions with the public the notion that greenhouse gas emissions are causing actual harm now, not just might cause harm in 50 to 100 years' time. I think that conversation has moved on in a lot of people's heads, and it has moved on in the past 10 years or so. And we are in a very different place now, thanks to the fact that climate is changing. We can see what's going on around us, and the science has also evolved to help us understand that.
And I think the challenge then is, how does law evolve in a robust and legitimate way to reflect that change in robust science? And that's the challenge, because in a sense, you know, people often talk about the law lagging, but really what that science is revealing is different ways to think about responsibility, and that we need to think about responsibility.
What are you envisaging, Liz, here? Some cases where apparently governments have set their own targets and therefore can be held liable. And then we've got the cases that Freddie's been discussing, where all we can say is there's a general probability.
But this is really not all we can say. We can make very strong statements. So we can say that, well, this heat wave is 2 degrees warmer. And that also means that from the impact of that heat wave, we can say that X amount more people have been killed because of climate change. So that is, just because it involves probabilities doesn't mean it's not a strong argument.
No, indeed. Yeah.
And I think in that kind of regard, you have to think about two different legal contexts. There are contexts for saying, is this person responsible for what happened in the past? And there, you know, the causation question is a very sort of front and center one. And it's very important because it goes to the heart of establishing responsibility. And I think that is difficult. And as Freddie was saying, there hasn't really been many cases on that at all. But the other issue, and this is coming back to the agenda case, is really about, well, what should governments be doing? So if we take agenda in the Court of Appeal, the main focus of the court was on a breach of Article 2 of the European Convention of Human Rights, which is the right to life. Now, science there is playing a different role, because you're trying to predict what will happen in the future. It's not about saying, is this individual liable for this amount of money for what happened in past? You're saying, what kind of duties are governments under?
So is this a bit like if I'm running a factory, then I'm under a duty to my workers to make sure that it's reasonably safe and the probability of them having an injury is very low?
The example that you give is the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974 that creates that general duty.
Yeah.
And of course, where your example is a very good one, is as conditions change, you may have to rethink your duty.
Hmm.
If we go to governments, governments aren't necessarily, it's going to depend on the legal culture, under such a general duty.
Right.
But as the law changes, as our understanding of what we expect government to do changes, we might also change the sense of what their legal duties are, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yes, I think so. Miles, when we spoke in the first episode of the series, you were emphasising how important it is that countries reduce their emissions quickly in a context where evidently the law is going to have to adapt a lot to deal with these difficulties. How important a mechanism is law for achieving these quick reductions?
Well, thinking back to that 2003 article, I wrote that at a time when the US had pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol. There didn't seem to be any prospect, really, of coordinated international action to reduce emissions. And so, again, I was sort of imagining whether there were any other avenues open to actually give companies in particular an incentive to stop using the atmosphere as landfill, if you like. I mean, at the moment, there's absolutely no reason for a company not to sell a product that ends up putting CO2 into the atmosphere, because ironically, if you take care of the CO2 generated by your power station and re-inject it underground, in many jurisdictions, you remain liable for it forever in case it might start to leak out. Whereas if you dump it in the atmosphere, you're fine. It's somebody else's problem.
Absurd.
At the moment, all of the incentives are the wrong way round. And there's no risk in a company building its business model around the notion of continuing to pollute the planet. So something has to change that. Now, one thing which could change it, of course, is government policy, and that's perhaps starting to have some impact on some companies' thinking, but it may well not be enough. And also, to address many of the harms which are already being caused by climate change, it may be that citizens will feel that they want recourse beyond what their government's offering to them. And this is where, you know, I think, as Liz was saying at the outset, it's inevitable that the courts are going to get involved in a situation like this where people feel they're being harmed by the activities of others.
And I think just following on from that, it needs to be recognised that some of these legal disputes are going to be these high-profile ones, like agenda. But a lot of these cases going to court around climate change are where a government has passed a very novel piece of legislation. Let's take the EU Emission Trading Scheme Directive. We've never really had a law like that. It creates these kind of allowances. It creates a process for setting a cap. It creates a registry. It is inevitable we are going to have legal disputes about how does that system work and how do we ensure it works so it actually works to deliver climate change reductions. And so litigation is also part of the working through of the legislation that we are passing.
Right. So the fact that litigation is taking place needn't be any evidence of any problems. This is standard working out of systems. When you bring in new regulations or new ways of doing things, you are bound to have legal cases that kind of polish them up.
Absolutely. And it's a legitimate way of developing an authoritative understanding of the regime. So a couple of years ago, I did a piece looking at all the cases challenging planning permissions about wind turbines to see, well, what are these cases actually about? And what you see is these cases are about, well, okay, we've got this commitment to renewable energy. How do we balance that commitment with things such as special protection areas for birds, of all things listed buildings, and how we go about protecting listed buildings and their settings? How do we interpret these policies? How do we think about a reasonable process for making decisions about wind turbines? And that body of case law helps us interpret that regime.
Picking up on the emission trading scheme, what's the downside for the governments of the EU over-allocating CO2 permits now? So is the EU allowing itself to emit as much CO2 as it wants? What's the downside for the EU in doing that? They might feel a bit guilty about it. They might get a few brickbats at international meetings, but there isn't really an obvious negative. The obvious losers from that policy today are the next generation, who actually have relatively little authority as voters in the EU, but potentially could seek redress through the courts. And that's the kind of thing which is happening. A lot of these cases are emerging as, at least presented, as intergenerational cases, young people taking the older generation to court.
And it's not only the generational issue, it's also, which is why I think the Peruvian farmer against RWE is such an actually really important case, even whether it wins or not, because there is one person who is representing those people who are already today paying the price for climate change. And that's the most vulnerable globally, but also in societies, the ones who don't have necessarily the means to protect themselves, who are usually not having a voice, who are usually not being involved in legislation and governmental decisions, but through courts may actually be made more visible. And I think that is a very important function that courts can have.
Taking a case to court can give a lot of visibility to your cause, whether you win or not.
In a way, yes. And I think, of course, it's of course better to win if you don't win. But I think it's one way of having a voice for people who don't necessarily have a voice.
I think we have to be careful with that description because it tells sort of the story of litigation as solely a political one. So if we take the example of the Peruvian farmer, I mean, if you look at the German Civil Code and that provision, on its face, we should actually be thinking about this issue. You know, it's an important legal question for us to be thinking about.
Yeah.
You know, here is someone in another place whose property is actually being harmed by action over here.
Right.
So how as lawyers do we want to think about that?
Sorry, Matt.
And if you look at the numbers, the global energy industry remains 85% fossil. The combined rents, so basically profits made by governments and the owners of fossil fuels as they come out of the ground, still dwarf estimates of the current impacts of climate change. So you've got a situation where one group of people are making a very large amount of money out of a process that's harming another group of people. Prima facie, that seems like a reasonable situation for the courts to get involved.
It does. But they are presumably constrained by the laws and the legal remedies that are in place.
They are. And I think coming back to this point about children bringing these actions, of course, these children aren't bringing actions about something that is not in the law. So if we take the emission trading scheme, that is about reducing emissions. A lot of these actions are not about sort of plucking some idea from nowhere. It is about saying, actually, what we are trying to do is enforce the law, because we know that the temptations of not actually dealing with climate change, because it is going to require some hard choices, you know, the courts have a role to enforce that. Just to use an example from an area closer to home is Client Earth's litigation in 2015 in the UK Supreme Court enforcing the Air Quality Directive. Now, again, air quality like climate change, collective action problem, very difficult to deal with. The Air Quality Directive requires member states, if areas don't meet the standards, to put in place management plans, but that, again, requires some hard choices. What Client Earth did in that case is bring an action enforcing the law. And the Supreme Court issued a mandatory order, and that is now bringing about significant change. So I think it's important to see that these actions, these litigants who we don't often think of as litigants, children bringing actions, that's, you know, that sounds radical. They're just enforcing the law.
But there seems to be a little bit of a tension here, because earlier on we were talking about how the law had to adapt.
Yeah.
And take new ideas on board in order to, as it were, have teeth to do the job. But now you're saying, or seem to be saying, that the law as it is has lots of teeth, and that there's no reason why these people can't bring cases and succeed.
Where I think the tension comes in is because governments have taken action on climate change, but often in quite legally novel ways. So if we take the Climate Change Act in this country, 2008, it has Section 1, a duty on the Secretary of State to reduce carbon emissions from the 1990 level now to zero by 2050. That's a really significant legal obligation. But how do you go about legally enforcing it?
Yeah, yeah. And 2050 is a conveniently long distance away for any politician thinking about the next 5 years, right?
So one way is to say, actually, it has no legal teeth.
Yeah.
But that shouldn't be. But then how do you give it legal meaning? That's where pushing the law comes in.
I see a bit of a problem here in that the countries that are getting challenged by law are those that have themselves brought in these various legal requirements. Now, Miles was making the point earlier that a country, if what it's most concerned about is its economy, it can print as many carbon credits as it likes. It can just license its industry to use the air as a dumping ground, and there's nothing anybody can do. Is that right?
So if we look at international law, international law is the law between consenting states. There are international courts, but in most cases, their jurisdiction is sort of voluntary. So you're quite right in the sense that we can't have a big international court come in and wield a big stick against a particular state. But going back to your kind of question about, well, isn't it unfair that those countries that are doing these things are the ones who are being taken to court, I would come back to the point I made at the beginning, which is to say legal disputes are inevitable over climate change. We shouldn't see them as a negative, this idea of suing or litigious.
Right.
What's important is this is part of the shift to a lower carbon economy, because in that process there are going to be conflicts, there are going to be disagreements. And taking cases to court is a way to do that as fairly as possible. And again, a lot of these cases are about accountability.
And the other part of this, of course, it's not all about countries. In fact, I frequently get frustrated with the fact that people talk about countries' emissions. Countries don't emit. Individuals emit, and overwhelmingly, companies are responsible for emissions. And where you've got large multinational companies operating in multiple jurisdictions, it's a lot harder for those companies to hide behind a wall of, oh, well, you know, the government in country X allowed us to do what we're doing because they're operating everywhere. So, you know, I think that's where the law introduces an extra element into corporate thinking about the risks of business as usual for carbon dioxide. And I think that's perhaps over time will become its most important role.
That's very interesting. Suppose you've got a multinational company that's working in a number of different jurisdictions. One might think that actually it's going to do most in the jurisdiction where it can get away with most. Are you saying actually the fact that it's in many different jurisdictions often forces it to adopt the most rigorous?
Well, I'm not saying that's happening now, but the point is it could, in the sense that if a multinational company were held responsible for the consequences of its emissions, regardless of where they were emitted, then you take away the incentive to that company to siphon off its high-emitting activities into parts of the world that have weak climate legislation.
And is it in fact the case that laws hold companies for liable no matter where the emissions took place?
Well, I mean, in general, that's the way cases have been argued so far. And it sort of makes sense from the point of view of the science, in that once you put CO2 in the atmosphere, it affects the weather everywhere. It doesn't specifically affect the weather in any particular location. Freddie was talking about the hard part of the attribution problem. The relatively easy part is how emissions over time have contributed to where we're at in the climate issue today, because carbon dioxide is a remarkably simple pollutant. If you dump CO2 in the atmosphere, it just stays there.
Right. And as you say, with a company, if it's emitting lots somewhere else, it's still clearly attributable to that company, and therefore it can be held liable here.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, the fossil fuel industry has kept almost obsessive records of what it's been doing for the planet for the past 80 years, and we should be grateful to them for that.
So an important role that law plays is it creates stability and calculability. So on the basis of what the law is, people plan their lives.
And companies plan their
lives. And they're companies that plan their lives. An important role of both climate change litigation and climate change legislation is it gives cues to companies about, well, where do we invest? What kind of projects should we be moving to? The Paris Agreement has been incredibly important because it's clear what the direction of travel is globally now. And those jurisdictions, if I take a country like Australia, which hasn't actually acted on, it doesn't have comprehensive climate change legislation at the federal level, energy markets, not the coal industry, but energy markets there are screaming out for legislation because they can see what the direction of travel is. Court cases also are a way of creating this kind of legal certainty.
And I think it's also not just with emissions, because it's also, for example, building standards. So if you think about the adaptation or the impact side, actually the industry is screaming out, okay, we have a net zero target and that needs to be followed up with legislation on how do we build buildings and so on. Can we have them now, please, so that we can
invest in appropriate, so we can plan, and
we know what we can invest where. And that, I think, is also something which I'm not sure if there are cases on this at the moment, but this could also be something how you sort of speed up a government legislation that is necessary, that is not quite there yet through the courts.
And I take it pressure on companies is not just coming from law, though it is partly from that, but also from their own shareholders and public and the people they're trying to sell to. And
yes, and as I understand it, lively discussions are going on within major companies about how to respond to the climate issue. And one of the difficulties those arguing within these companies for more progressive action on climate change is that they're up against other people are arguing, well, the companies have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to deliver maximal returns. And as long as governments allow them to carry on dumping CO2 in the atmosphere, there's no downside to that. So it's almost their duty to carry on doing it. I mean, there's an argument about, you know, there's an argument to be had about that. So, you know, again, introducing this notion of potential responsibility for the consequences of those emissions, even if it's pretty hypothetical and far off in the future, might change the dynamic of those conversations.
That's very interesting. I mean, the points just made suggest that making laws that to some extent circumscribe what companies can do could be seen as something that the companies would welcome. Because of the predictability, because it gives them a license to do actually what they want to do, but may feel constrained against because of the fiduciary duty to benefit their shareholders and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, the worst case scenario for the fossil fuel industry is a global panic in the 2030s, in which all of their assets get seized and these companies are devalued to nothing overnight. Because then it's not so much their shareholders lose money, the executives lose their jobs.
Yeah.
And you know, that's something which would keep an executive awake at night. So the point is, you know, they want to avoid that risk, and therefore the more that risk becomes potentially a real one, the more pressure will come from the industry itself for effective regulation.
Right. Okay. Changing tack slightly, we've been talking about these court cases and their impact both on countries and companies. What role is scientific evidence playing in these various disputes and litigation?
So from one perspective, you could say not much directly. So particularly in cases being brought against governments, the science is really playing a background role. But with that said, it's a really important background role.
Just setting the scene that we all know this is required.
Climate change is a problem. Yeah. So particularly if we look at the IPCC reports, the roles that they play in the agenda litigation, even in Massachusetts and EPA back from 2007, which was the issue about whether the US EPA should regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. You know, it is playing, it is stable. That science is kind of stabilizing our understanding of what the reality is. But with that said, except in perhaps the Peruvian case, the science is not front and centre, and the science is not actually being litigated.
Right.
If that makes sense.
You mean that we're not having disputes in court about the science?
Absolutely. So mainly it's about what does pollutant mean under the Clean Air Act for the Massachusetts and EPA? You know, what is the nature of this legal duty? Now, there are some exceptions to that, and I think Miles might have been involved in a case.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a case last year taken between cities of San Francisco and Oakland against some major oil companies, where the cities were arguing that because of products sold by those major oil companies, the cities were having to invest in defending their airports against sea level rise. And in that case, the judge in the District Court of California actually assigned an entire day to science, and he wanted to have hearings from both sides. So both sides had 2 hours on the science to present to the court to provide the scientific context for the. It wasn't expert testimony as such, it was a tutorial to the court, I think is what he called it. And it was a very interesting exercise. It was very interesting to see what the scientific issues under dispute were. One of the things which was really interesting about that was the oil companies did not choose to dispute the science of climate change at all. So there were several amicus curiae briefs submitted by the usual suspects suggesting that the oil companies should take the opportunity to blame it all on sunspots or whatever. And the oil companies, I suspect quite wisely, ignored that advice and went with that they completely accepted the IPCC science and focused very much on the uncertainties that were prevalent at different stages of the process and the argument that they could not have foreseen the level of harm, they could not reasonably have been expected to have foreseen the level of harm that is now becoming obvious as a result of climate change when they were making decisions back in the 1980s. So a lot of the arguments about science in that case seem to be turning around who knew what when rather than what is the truth, if you see what I mean? And that clearly is an interesting question, although fair to say that case was thrown out by that court, so the plaintiffs lost, not on the scientific questions at all, but actually in that case the judge's view was very firmly that weighing up the benefits of fossil fuel use against the harms caused by fossil fuel use was something that was above his pay grade, so to speak. So he was that was his reason for for dismissing that case was not particularly an issue with the science at all.
That raises some very interesting and general issues, doesn't it? I mean, nobody in the Industrial Revolution in Britain could have foreseen that digging coal out of the ground would have these great effects. But it's often said that countries such as Britain have a special duty to do something about climate change because of the impacts of past usage. And that seems a fair point, doesn't it?
Yes, and I do like to draw attention to the fact. One thing I did get out of preparing for that case, which, by the way, was probably the most nerve-wracking thing I've had to do in my entire career, was going back over who knew what when in the scientific community. It is remarkable when you go back to the 70s just how prescient the scientists of the day were. And it's worth going back to read the Charney Report. And indeed, there's a figure in a report that Bill Nordhaus produced in 1977 in which he made a prediction of how global temperatures would evolve under business as usual over the next 100 years. And he said that in this decade, we would reach 1 degree. Got it exactly right. He also predicted that temperatures would accelerate in this decade. And so we've got to hope that he got that part of the forecast wrong. But so far, his forecast has been exactly correct. And that was based on understanding how carbon dioxide affects climate. Because at the time he made the prediction, global temperatures were, if anything, slightly cooling.
Well, there were worries about a possible ice age.
In the newspapers, yes, people were talking about a new ice age. And so it was clear how well people actually understood the physics that early on.
Yeah, some might say you're cherry-picking. You've got one scientist who made correct predictions and maybe others, as we've heard, were suggesting something very different.
That is something that the climate deniers love to say. But actually, if you look back, most scientists in the 70s were climate scientists, were talking about global warming, and very few were talking about the possible cooling. So right. It's not cherry-picking.
I think the other really important thing, coming back to the role of courts, is nearly everything that the courts are involved in litigating in is future looking. So this notion, you know, so it is not about a sort of past, you know, what did someone know in 1963? It is actually about how do we as a society move forward in a fair kind of way to deal with climate change.
Right. But fairness may sometimes involve asking, how could a company reasonably have expected such and such to come about, could it?
Well, I think so I think if we look at the kind of discussion and adding to your about the role of shareholders, the role of pension funds, investment decisions, most of that is looking about how does a company act responsibly going forward.
But I think even if it is not necessarily relevant in the current court cases, I think the fact that these court cases are brought forward and that people look into the question who knew what when now is quite remarkable. And I think it's very important that actually, in particular, the fossil fuel companies, Exxon, for example, they had their own scientists and they knew in the 50s and 60s very well what the relationship between burning fossil fuels and global temperature rise is, and then choose not to tell the public about it, or even worse, confuse the public about that. So I think even if this is not part of the litigation at the moment, it is quite important that this is part of the public discussion about climate change that we have.
And looking forward, if climate policy ever really starts to bite, we're going to have, you know, leaders and laggards. There's going to be companies that are ahead of the game and doing their bit and reducing their emissions and so on. There's going to be other companies who are trying to profit by being the last out of the sweet shop, so to speak. That's a situation where I think the law may well have quite a strong role to play. Shell, for example, is already selling a brand of petrol that they are branding as carbon neutral. We can have a long conversation about exactly how they're working out that this petrol is carbon neutral, but they're taking responsibility for the carbon content of the petrol they sell and trying to offset it. So that's one company essentially acknowledging that it has some kind of responsibility. I'm sure it wouldn't regard it as a legal responsibility. They're just doing this more as a marketing exercise. But they're accepting implicitly they have some kind of responsibility for the carbon content of the products they sell. Other companies are not doing that. As that moves from, you know, the marketing division to the the legal division within companies, that's going to have to be resolved, because we can't have companies having a competitive advantage by going slower on climate change. That wouldn't be fair on the companies that are doing the right thing, and it certainly would slow down action on the whole problem.
So you think legal systems will have to adapt to take that point into account?
Yeah, and they do in lots of other areas. So you know, we often think of regulation as bad for the economy, but regulation is creating the rules of the game.
To make a level playing field.
A level playing field where that level playing field takes into account things like worker protection, environmental protection, etc. And it's really the fact that historically it hasn't taken into account climate change.
So the level playing field now needs to take something into account that previously it didn't.
And that is where I think this role for law needing to evolve comes in. And because climate change is a global collective action problem, that can be a bit challenging, but it's not impossible.
One interesting point that struck me with what Freddie was saying, Liz, you talked about the law being forward-looking, but actually sometimes being forward-looking can involve an element of looking backwards as well. If we look back, Freddie, and we find that companies actually lied about what they knew, then there is a good reason for prosecuting them now in order to make sure that companies in the future act on their best information rather than suppressing it, right? So it is quite important when you're looking forward to give companies an example of being punished for wrongdoing. Is that fair? Silence.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to the fact that companies need to weigh up benefits and consequences. And so, you know, if misinformation has negative consequences, then perhaps there'll be a discouragement. They'd be discouraged from indulging in it.
Isn't there a parallel here with what happened with the tobacco companies?
So I think, and there's some slightly quizzical looks around the table, which I think reflects the fact that this isn't actually what's going on in the case law at the moment. And I think that's just interesting to reflect on. Yes, it's possible. And if we think about the case that Mars was involved in actual fact, the really successful tobacco litigation was brought against by the US states against the companies for the healthcare costs.
Right.
But I don't think that's really where a lot of this legal action is. It is about this transition.
Yeah.
And I think just thinking about historical perspectives, if we go back to the 19th century and the fact that we built cities without sewage systems, which then, you know, just a bit like Mars was describing the atmosphere as a landfill, the streets were where sewage got dumped. Now, sorting out that problem and getting people to take responsibility took nearly 50 years. It took a lot of litigation. It took a lot of legislation. It did get sorted. Mm. And the law had a really, it wasn't the only thing. No. You know, science had a role to play. But it was an important
part, a key role.
Mm. In making sure that that was real. And I often think, you know, if you go back to 1842 Liverpool, the average life expectancy of a working class man then was 17 and a half. If you took someone from 1842 Liverpool and showed them Liverpool today, it would be unimaginable. And law does, you know, this kind of litigation has a powerful role to play in that transition.
Yeah. We haven't got 50 years, sadly.
Well, we're going to be working on this for 50 years, no matter what. You know, whether we're successful or not, this whole issue is going to be playing itself out over the next century, because the change we're talking about is going to take that long. And that's not being defeatist. That's just saying that even once we've managed to get emissions to net zero, there's going to be arguments going on about who's still emitting, whether they're compensating for their emissions adequately, whether they're actually compliant with a net zero world or not. The lawyers are going to be still involved in that.
Well, and also when we have net zero emissions, we have still climate change. It's not as if we are going back. We already have 1 degree of warming, and that has already led to impacts. And the 1.5 or 2 degree warming will also lead to a lot of more impacts. And we need to build cities that are resilient to these impacts. And I think their law has potentially a very big role to play. Who's going to be responsible for protecting the cities in the future and in the present? And who is going to give the information and the tools needed to deal with this climate that is different? So that is just a fact that we are living with, no matter what happens on the mitigation side.
People are clearly very conscious of this. It really struck me that the clearest sentence in the Paris Agreement was the little sentence in the decisions that Article 8 on loss and damage shall not provide a basis for liability or compensation. And it was surrounded by lots of, you know, rather sort of complicated legalese and hard to understand sentences. And then suddenly there's this two-line sentence in the middle of the decisions to make it very clear that certain people are very conscious of the possibility that Article 8 might be interpreted as providing a basis for liability and compensation, and they wanted to shut that argument down.
And do you think they were right to shut that down?
Well, it certainly would open some pretty interesting discussions if it were to provide a basis for liability and compensation. This is the principle that countries that have caused climate change would have a duty to compensate those that are most affected by climate change.
So it might make them rather reluctant to take it on board.
Well, clearly, I don't know which countries insisted on inserting these two lines, but I'm guessing it wasn't the small island states. Clearly, countries are very conscious of this possibility because logic suggests that if one country causes a problem and another country is adversely affected by it, there's a certain basic
natural law
to some liability or compensation applying, which is why there's clearly a lot of defensiveness around this.
Well, thank you very much. That's been a really interesting conversation. Just to conclude, I'd be very interested to hear your views on this little nexus of questions. What do you think future climate law will look like? What do you think it ought to be like? And are there any fundamental issues that we need to solve to get there? Liz?
What will it look like? It will increasingly look like business as usual. And what I mean by that is that given that we live in societies which we're using carbon and we're emitting carbon, we are going to have to think about how we're going to deal with that, and law is going to have a role to play in that. And so it's going to become part of our daily life. And when I talk about business, I mean the business of the role of companies, the role of government, how we build our houses, transport, et cetera, et cetera. What should it look like? It's important that we have a body of law that, in creating that business as usual, is as fair and as just as possible. And there is going to be a big role for legislation in that. And just to give you an example, the state of Victoria, its Climate Change Act is a really fascinating law, which not only has a general duty to reduce emissions to zero by 2050, but then it also has a whole set of kind of sub-obligations, a cascade of obligations to get everyone thinking in government about the issue of climate change. That creates a stable frame for moving forward. But that's thinking about government. There is also a really important role for how companies are going to carry out their business.
Yes, and I think when companies are thinking about planning for the future, and the agents in this business, the agents who are making the multi-decade investments that will determine whether we get to net zero or not in 2050 are not governments. It's companies that are building stuff that is still going to be around and operating in 50 years' time. So it's thinking within these companies that ultimately has to evolve if we're going to address the climate problem successfully. And, you know, to go back to that 2003 article, the question I was really asking was, if governments were actually to shrug their shoulders and admit that they actually couldn't solve the problem at all, but at the same time to say that as a result, everybody would be held liable for the consequences of emissions from the products they sold forever, how would that change the thinking of companies? Would it actually then make more sense for companies to dispose of CO2 carefully and not dump it in the atmosphere, rather than just carrying on with business as usual? I didn't really answer that question in the article. I'm not quite sure I know what the answer is now, but I think it's worth thinking about just in the abstract.
And I think that thinking about is a very important role that just these court cases or this litigation actually plays, because when we talk about climate change otherwise in society, we always talk about nation states and we talk about individuals, but focusing on the companies who we, as Mal said, need to solve the problem is one way where the courts can play an important role. You ask, is it a good thing that the Paris Agreement included the clause on loss and damage does not mean compensation? And I think in a way it does, because if it would not have included that clause, we would not have loss and damage as part of the Paris Agreement. But now we have loss and damage as Article 8 of the Paris Agreement, but we actually have no definition of what loss and damage means. And so In the Paris Agreement or also in other national laws, loss and damage is not something that we have worked out how to deal with. But we acknowledge now in the Paris Agreement that it's happening. So we have losses and damages because of climate change happening today. And so I think the courts could play or will play a very important role in figuring out what do we actually mean with loss and damage and how can we address it in a way that is, well, hopefully fair and as just as possible.
So one of the very common themes in discussions of climate policy is that climate policy is all about the state against the individual. Witness the Gilets Jaunes in France, you know, the poor car driver being, you know, dumped on yet again more taxes because they, some faceless state, want to do something about climate change. The really interesting thing about these court cases is they turn that around. A faceless entity, a company that sold a lot of fossil fuels, has devalued your house. And suddenly, the individual's on the side of climate action, as opposed to being pitted against it. And that, I think, is a really interesting dynamic.
Okay, so we've got a pretty fundamental nexus of problems here. Loss, damage, responsibility, finding new legal frameworks for moving forward. That this has been a really interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My thanks again to Freddie, Liz and Miles for their time this week. And also to all of our listeners of Future Makers. Next week, we step out of the courtroom and back into the wider world to ask whether climate change conflict might be on the way, or even here already. We want to tell as many people as possible about our current series and to inspire lots of discussions on climate research. Please help us by leaving a rating or review on the podcast provider you use, or just by telling a friend about the show. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.